This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Thank you all for coming. My name is Ethan Rarick. I'm with the Institute of Governmental Studies. This is part of a year-long series. I know some of you have been to other events in this series called Choosing the President, Campaigning and Governing in War and Peace. We've had a series of panel discussions of issues of importance in the presidential election and issues that will face the next president, whoever he or she turns out to be. Many of those events have already occurred. For those of you who are interested in seeing webcasts of those events, you can go to the IGS website, which is igs.berkeley.edu. And this event in due course will be webcast as well. Let me introduce the moderator, and then he'll take over and introduce the panelists. Max Nyman is the Associate Director and a Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California over in San Francisco, which has many ties to IGS. Prior to joining PPIC, he had a long and very distinguished career at UC Riverside, where he was a professor of political science. He's now a professor emeritus at Riverside. He also, during his time at Riverside, held many administrative posts. He was chair of the Political Science Department, Associate Dean of Academic Affairs. He was also chair of the UC System-Wide Committee on Research Policy. He's written widely on many issues, including immigration. The most recent of his books is Custodians of Place, Urban Growth and Development in California Cities. And with that, I will turn it over to Max.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm not sure what word to use. Stand-in, substitute, none of those things can you really do for Jack Citrin, who was supposed to be here. But I'm here instead, and it's a real pleasure to introduce this very distinguished panel. I think what I'd like to do is say a few things about each of them, let them do their thing for a short period of time. Perhaps give them a few minutes to have a couple of afterthoughts or responses, and then open it up as soon as possible to the Q&A. First of all, I'd like to introduce Frank Bean, who's to my immediate right, who's a Chancellor's Professor of Sociology and Economics and Director of the Center for Research on Immigration, Population, and Public Policy at UC Irvine. And prior to joining the UC, he served as Ashbel Smith Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs, Director of the Population Research Center, and Chair of the Department of Sociology at University of Texas at Austin, and also had a distinguished career at the Urban Institute, where he was the founding director of both the Program for Research on Immigration Policy and the Population Studies Center. He's written numerous books and articles, although I heard him say he was working on another one, and his most recent book, America's Newcomers and Dynamics of Diversity, which is the one I'm familiar with, which has been reviewed very positively and is noted for the accessibility that it brings to the public of the immigration issue without sacrificing technical ability. Next to Frank is Philip Martin, who's a professor of agriculture and resource economics at UC Davis. He's the chair of the UC Comparative Immigration and Integration Program. He has a wonderful career and experience in negotiating the worlds of politics, policy application, and scholarship. He's the recipient of UCD's Distinguished Public Service Award. He assessed the prospects for Turkish migration to European Union. Evaluated the effects of immigration on Malaysia's economy and its labor markets, was a member of the Binational Study of Migration, and in 2001-02, he assessed the options for dealing with unauthorized immigration into Thailand. He's got a prodigious research record on migrant and agricultural workers in the United States and in California, and as well as demonstrating his versatility, he's made forays into some really excellent political science and legal analysis, which has been published in the International Migration Review. The one I'm familiar with is his article on Proposition 187. And he also has a very fascinating analysis of the unintended consequences of the agriculture of the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, fondly known as IRCA. And is, of course, associated with lots of scholarly works, including The Mirage of Mexican Guest Workers in Foreign Affairs magazine. And third but not least, all the way at the end, is Peter Salins, University Professor of Political Science at SUNY Stony Brook. He's a former provost and vice chancellor for academic affairs at the State of University of New York, a fellow of the American Institute of Certified Planners, director of the Citizens Housing and Planning Council of New York. His most recent book, one which has garnered a fair amount of attention, is what I consider to be a positive and affectionate book, but one in, which is to some extent controversial, called Assimilation American Style. He's authored, co-authored and edited a variety of books, Scarcity by Design, The Ecology of Housing Destruction, New York Unbound. He's published articles in a wide variety of newspapers, periodicals, and scholarly journals. He wrote a fairly widely noted article in op-ed piece in the New York Times, which I also read, on employer sanctions, which got quite a bit of attention, and we're having a discussion about whether it's actually influenced presidential policy or not. But for me, the most important thing, he's been on the Charlie Rose Show, which I think is enviable indeed. So without further ado, why don't we just go ahead and start in order here? One, two, three.
Thank you, Max. Can everybody hear? Is this on? Thank you very much, Ethan and the Institute of Government, for inviting me to participate in this. And thank all of you for coming. This is, immigration is a tough issue. It's become more controversial. You've probably heard lots about it and know lots about it, so it's hard to know what we could say that might be new. But maybe we can touch upon two or three things. My job is to finish on time so that my colleagues will have some time left. I'm especially sensitive to that because things almost always go in reverse alphabetical order, and I'm left at the end with no time. I counted at least four stories in today's New York Times that I thought were relevant for immigration, which I think illustrates just how important the issue is and how much it touches on so many other parts of our life these days and on so many other important policy issues. It is a major concern for whoever the new president is. About 8 or 9 years ago, I was a member of a group, I believe Phil was too, 10 people from the United States, 10 from Mexico, who were asked by the Carnegie Endowment to come together to draft policy proposals for whoever the new president would be, whether it was going to be. When we started the work, the nominees were not yet selected, but it was the first time in a long time, I believe it was first time in 12 years, maybe longer than that, that there was going to be a new president in Mexico and a new president who was not an incumbent in the United States. We met with Vicente Fox. We met with Representative, because he was, by all accounts, going to be the Mexican president. We met with representatives of the Gore campaign and representatives of the Bush campaign. And the policy proposals that this group drafted under the leadership of Mac McCarty, who had been chief of staff in the Clinton administration for a while, and Andres Rosenthal, were the backbone for the blueprint for the proposals that the Bush administration was ready to go with when they got in office. And, of course, about the time the Bush administration took the reins of government, recession was underway, and not too long after that, 2 days after Vicente Fox was in New York and then to meet with Bush at Washington, I believe, not New York, 9/11 occurred. And everything went off the table and was off the table for a long time until this latest go-round of proposals. So what's going to happen with the next president? You know, I think it's useful to think a little bit about context. One thing that I think more people realize now than used to, and that was true in 1999 leading up to the election of that year, is that the United States really does need these unskilled workers that come in such great numbers, so many of whom are unauthorized these days. And, you know, if we believe public opinion polls, somewhere from 60% to three-fourths of the population acknowledges that, even if some of those persons don't necessarily favor the kinds of policies we've had. And we need them for economic reasons. We need them. And here's something I think that's not widely acknowledged: for demographic reasons. Our birth rate is pretty low. It's been pretty low for a long time. A little story I tell, I'm going to run out of time, but I'll tell it because I think it's so interesting. Over the last 15 years, if we look at the state of Iowa, Iowa's the second oldest state in the United States in terms of its average age structure. The oldest, of course, is Florida. And the reason Florida has such an old age structure is so many elderly people move there. The reason Iowa has such an elderly age structure is so many young people leave. And the reason they leave is not because it's a crummy place. They actually have a good education system. I'm sure somebody is here from Iowa who's going to be upset with my comments, but it's not because Iowa's a bad place. It's, you know, it just doesn't have a lot of jobs. Anyway, if you slice the Iowa population forwards, backwards, sideways, etc., any way you can think of, more people of that slice left the state in the last 15 years than moved into the state. There's only one kind of person I've been able to find that was more likely to go to Iowa than to leave, and that's illegal Mexican workers, unauthorized Mexican workers. Is that because they're dumb? No. I mean, it's because there's scut work there that needs doing, just as there is almost everywhere. So why is this such a big issue? I mean, if we need these workers, if they're contributing to our economy, New York Times editorial today about their contribution to the Social Security system, which is a sort of hidden bonus that the country receives because they don't withdraw benefits. Why is it so controversial, and why is there so much intensity of feeling against migration, especially unauthorized migration, and especially unauthorized Mexican migration? I think there's some easy answers, but I think those are not very helpful from a policy point of view or from an analytical point of view. One that I think makes a difference, and the reason these are important, I think, is whether the next president is McCain or Obama or Clinton, all three of those politicians are fairly pro-immigration. If there's a Democratic Congress, which I think is a high probability, then the political conditions for enacting immigration legislation are probably going to be pretty favorable. But I think a lot of the intensity of negative response about immigration derives from, I think Lou Dobbs is half right in some of what he's been saying. He says the middle class has been getting a raw deal. That's the part I think he's right about. He says immigration seems to account for a lot of that. That's the part, in my opinion, I think he's wrong about. But I do think he's right about the middle class having been neglected. We know all the data and the statistics about inequality, earnings inequality, et cetera, et cetera. A story again in the New York Times today about how much wealthy people benefit from the mortgage deduction on home ownership. The middle class does not benefit nearly as much, in part because well over half the members of the middle class don't itemize deductions. Anyway, that's just one example of all the different kinds of ways that the middle class has suffered for the last 30, 35 years. I think some of what we see in the way of anti-immigration response derives from that set of circumstances. And it manifests itself in being opposed to illegal migration. I think in part because it's hard to argue with anybody who's opposed to something that's illegal. And so it provides a convenient outlet for other kinds of concerns and injustices, which leaves us at the same place going into the next presidential election as we've been in for the past 30 years. And that's that we have a real hard time adopting immigration reforms in the United States, whether it's for high-skilled, high-tech workers, agricultural workers who would be guest workers or temporary workers of some kind or other. Phil can address that in greater depth and knowledge than myself. Increases in legal immigrants of one kind or another, because the first thing, you know, after all the shouting back and forth, everybody says, well, we've got to deal with unauthorized migration before we can do anything else. That happened in the 80s, happened in the 70s, it happened with the latest round of negotiations. It's going on right now. As soon as we secure our borders, then we'll have immigration reform. So the mantra goes. So whoever the next president is, we really need better immigration policies for economic reasons, for demographic reasons. But it's the conditions are such that we may get them politically, but they may not be very popular because some of these larger contextual issues are still not being satisfactorily addressed.
Well, thank you. I'm number two, and I thank all of you for being here on such a nice day. Let me just try to make three points and take a slightly different tack from Frank, and so that you get, a slightly different perspective on some of these things. The first thing is that for the new president, immigration is not likely to be a first 100 days issue. It's not likely to be a first year issue. It's maybe not even be a first term issue. Most of the briefing books that are being prepared for whoever the next president is are saying this is a controversial and complex issue. It is very easy to get. This could be a third rail. It could ruin your presidency at the very beginning. People have strong opinions about it. Tread very lightly. So even though all three candidates are associated with what would be called comprehensive immigration reform, and for those of you who don't follow that, that means a combination of increased enforcement as well as legalization for some unauthorized workers. All three are declared in favor of that. I would not look for quick action on immigration, for many of the reasons that Frank mentioned. The second thing is that when the Congress or the president goes to actually enact something, it would be very good to keep history in mind and remember that usually the best way to predict what the impact of an immigration bill will be is to read the bill and assume exactly the opposite, and you will be correct. In 1965, we changed the law and got rid of national origins. And we said at the time, it will not change the flow of immigrants. It changed the flow of immigrants. In 1986, we thought 3 to 5 million unauthorized foreigners. President Reagan said, this is a tough thing we're doing, but future generations are going to be grateful to us for doing it. Now we have 12 million unauthorized foreigners. In general, whenever we try to do something, we're trying to regulate the behavior of people. We have a big credibility gap with government, and not just the U.S. government. Other governments also have that same problem. But government has not proven to be very effective at implementing the policies that it sets out. And then the third, so not a quick issue. It's not clear that whatever we say we're going to do, we're actually going to be able to do. And then the third thing is that what makes the debate difficult is that it usually, I mean, the real world is a lot trickier than the sound bites on TV, and a lot of people try to portray immigration as good or bad. The good is the economic side that Frank mentioned, is often mentioned. The bad is often the criminality side. because there are, in fact, people who commit U.S. crimes, who are deported, who return, and all that sort of thing. The difficulty is both of those are partial truths. I mean, then the crime is often exaggerated, et cetera. But the hard thing is that there really are some honest trade-offs in trying to make an immigration policy. And a trade-off, as we teach in economics, is actually a choice between two good things, not between a bad and a good. And choosing between two good things is an incredibly difficult thing to do, especially sometimes. So let me pick up on the example that Frank mentioned, which is meatpacking jobs in Iowa. Having been through several of these so-called disassembly plants, you realize that when the companies moved out of Chicago, starting in the 1980s, meatpacking paid as much as auto workers paid. So in other words, the jobs in Swift and Chicago and stuff, they paid exactly the same wages that people in auto assembly plants do. Today, those jobs in Iowa meatpacking pay about $8 or $10 an hour. And I think if you go to Detroit and still have a job, it's like $25 an hour. The issue when the plants moved out was from Chicago to the Midwest. The issue really was that it was a logical economic issue. It takes about 6 pounds of feed to make a pound of pork. So why not ship 1 pound of meat to the city as opposed to shipping 6 pounds? Keep grow the pork where the feed is and then just send the meat in, and that made a lot of sense. The issue was usually not the day shift. In fact, if you look at EEOC data, 55% of the people employed in U.S. meatpacking, the biggest manufacturing industry in rural America, are white or black. Only 45% are Hispanic. Of course, that 45% Hispanic is up from 5% Hispanic 20 years ago, so the rate of increase is huge. But the issue usually was the evening shift. In the plants in the cities, they usually didn't work at night. And so whenever you see these high turnover jobs in rural areas, what you normally find is that you're moving in. Some of these plants have 2,000 employees on two shifts in a city of 15,000 or a town of 15,000. And usually you divide the town population by two. That gives you the labor force. So you're getting a pretty big employer there. And what you need is people who are willing to move to that town. And remember, town of 15,000 with a 2,000-employee disassembly plant, that means there's probably not a lot of housing there. So you need people who are willing to live in the housing there and live reasonably close together because you're not going to put up the housing terribly quickly. And so in a very short order with some of these very big plants, we had a whole system of recruitment, you know how the networks work and all that sort of stuff. There is a question, if I am running the Tyson pork disassembly plant, I actually need those people. But need is not a term that's in economics books. We talk about demand. And what we always talk about is there are alternatives. You can drink beer or you can drink wine. It's not good maybe to drink them both. You can hire people, but you can actually reduce the number of people enormously on the disassembly lines with all kinds of electric knives and water knives. You know, chickens are about exactly the same size. They use robotics in some countries. But people, of course, are better than any machines. So when you think about this trade-off thing, there is an important anti-immigrant element that is seen on television a lot. People don't like change. Immigration means change, and they're opposed to immigration. But there's also a legitimate trade-off argument, which is that those wages in those plants are probably one-third of what they were 25 years ago. Okay? So in this country, if you are moving plants to where there aren't people and then looking for workers, you're going to have not enough workers. And the question then becomes, what should be done about that? Now, it's clear there's a lot of people who would want to come in and take those jobs. And roughly, the decision that we've made is to allow that to happen because there are employer sanctions. There is an E-Verify system. But as you well know, that system doesn't work terribly well. I sense that what will happen as we move ahead in the next several years is we're going to have a debate. The debate, unfortunately, will be very much dominated by the people on the one hand who say there should be no borders, the people on the other hand who say there should be no migrants, and we don't usually find durable solutions at the extremes. They're usually somewhere in the middle. Having an honest debate about the trade-offs is one of the hardest things to do. But I guess I would maintain that on the unskilled end, the unskilled unauthorized end, in general, if we were to see wages rise, take California agriculture. We employ 1 million people sometime during a typical year at roughly $8.50 an hour. If wages were $12, my bet is we would reduce that by 200,000 or 300,000 people. So how would you do that? I don't know exactly, because that's what everybody says. I need those people. But we have little machines that shake all those almonds off the trees. They can also shake peaches off the trees. Somebody picking the peaches will give me 80 good peaches. The machine will only give me 50. Now, which do you want? I mean, you have to throw more of them away. There's always, the point is not that there's a right or a wrong answer, but that there are always alternatives. And we make value judgments in society all the time. You cannot, having traveled the world, you cannot have a hand carpet weaving industry and have little girls in school. You just can't have that. Most countries have decided it's more important to have little girls in school. And so we've made a value judgment. Those are jobs we could have and we don't have because we've decided we don't want that. That same principle applies in a whole lot of other things. You can't predict exactly what will happen, but in general, at the low end of the labor market, the low end wage end of the labor market, the flexibility is on the demand side of the labor market, not the supply. So if we raise the wages for strawberry pickers from $8 to $11, we're not going to get a lot of you people out there picking strawberries. But we will figure out how to get strawberries picked. It may be that we'll import more of them. That's always also an alternative. So it's not like there won't be adjustment costs. There will be. But in making those trade-offs, we rarely get an honest debate about what the competing goods are. Instead, we do float the debate up to these people are coming in, they're changing us for this way for the better or this way for the worse. I think if we can focus some of the discussion on trade-offs and how things work, we might get a better debate, although I don't think we'll reach any kind of resolution in the near term. Thank you.
I know we're supposed to be brief, and I will try to be. I have a number of points to cover. First of all, good afternoon, and I very much enjoy the opportunity to join you on this very important subject. I agree with Frank that this is one of our most important policy topics, and I believe, in contradiction to Phil, that it will be settled one way or another in, if not the first year, perhaps the second year of the next president's term. Let me begin with some of my very strongly held assumptions, or you can call them biases, that drive my personal policy recommendations. Number one, immigration is a firmly grounded demographic fact. It has been and will continue to be good for the United States. 12.5% of the American population is foreign-born, pretty much a record since at least the beginning of the last century. 20% of the population lives in immigrant households. 15% of the labor force is foreign-born. That's even larger than the 12.5% that's in the population. Immigrants are less criminal than Native Americans. In fact, immigrants of all ethnic and national backgrounds commit fewer crimes and are far less likely to be incarcerated than Native Americans, either of their own ethnic background or even of Native Americans overall. Furthermore, contrary to widespread perception, overall immigration education levels are comparable to those of the Native population. So immigration is here and immigration is good. Number two, and this is, I think, where I probably most depart from my fellow panelists, the most important goal of immigration policy is not labor market-based. The most important goal of the policy, regardless of what happens on the ground, the policy should be directed to the successful assimilation of immigrants. Labor market consideration should be secondary. Labor market factors operate for only one generation at most. It is essential that the immigrants, and especially that their descendants, be socially integrated into American society. Unsuccessful assimilation leads to conditions we see in Europe and many other immigration-impacted countries around the world. And that's the reason we can't be so complacent about the large illegal population. Third, almost all of our current illegal immigrants are here to stay. They will not be deported, and they will not leave voluntarily. Therefore, their status must be legalized. All proposals to deport masses of illegal immigrants are blowing smoke. We haven't the resources, the will, or the political support to do any such thing. Nor is there evidence that more than a handful of illegals will voluntarily resettle in their native country. Fourth, Americans will not agree to a package of immigration reform until further illegal immigration is seriously curtailed. Frank mentioned that point, but was, I think, unhappy about it. I'm not unhappy. I think that is job one. The failure of immigration reform in the last congressional session can be attributed to widespread skepticism, not unfounded, regarding the federal government's sincerity about curtailing further illegal immigration. And fifth, my last assumption, the reason that we have so much illegal immigration is because the legal immigration framework is seriously flawed. The majority of eager potential immigrants around the world are not eligible for any of the legal immigration pathways. In 2006, we admitted 1.27 million immigrants. 65% of them were family-sponsored, 13% were employer-sponsored, 18% were refugees and asylees. Add those three numbers together, and it's almost 100%. These three categories exclude most of the world. They even exclude most Mexicans. So I actually have an immigration reform plan that I brought with me, and I would beg the chair's indulgence to let me get through the major points of the reform. I don't agree with Philip that immigration law always is either futile or achieves the opposite of what it's intended. In the 1920s, we intended to cut off immigration. We did, and we essentially stopped immigration effectively for decades. In 1965, regardless of the language surrounding the passage of the bill, the point of the bill was to liberalize immigration. It did. You can argue that IRCA under Reagan didn't quite close the illegal immigration door that it was supposed to, but I think that was because there was a lot of wink, wink, nod, nod, even at the time that the bill was actually passed. So I think that I do believe, as a professor of public policy, that you can pass public policies that do what they're supposed to do. If we're honest and intelligent, we can achieve successful immigration reform. Here's my three points. Number one, get serious about new illegal immigration. Frank is correct. That is the thing holding up immigration reform. And I don't think it's just a matter of bigotry. It is a precondition. Solving that problem is a precondition for any further meaningful immigration reform. I have four components to my recommendation in the immigration reform plan. First, expand the basic pilot program establishing a national legal identity database grounded primarily in Social Security enrollment. Number two, require the Social Security Administration to check for and sanction fraudulent Social Security numbers. That was the point of my op-ed. I think it is eminently doable, notwithstanding the court case in California and other objections. Number three, impose much higher penalties for employers who knowingly, that means in the face of absent documentation, hire illegal immigrants. And I would include among those employers ordinary households with their nannies, housekeepers, and gardeners, although, contrary to popular belief, the vast majority of illegal immigrants actually work for firms, not for households. And finally, in this first point, crack down on the overstayers. Not everybody sneaks across the border. Many come in perfectly legally by airplanes or other means of transportation. We can and should track the status of all individuals who enter with visitor or other temporary visas. This is no small task. Last year, the United States had 28 million visitors, 1.5 million temporary workers and their families, and 1.1 million students and family members. So it's a lot of people to track, but I think that with our modern computer technology, we can do that. Number two, perhaps controversial among some, but I think inevitable, we must legalize the status of most current illegal immigrants. And furthermore, I believe this is politically acceptable if at the same time we curtail further illegal immigration. In a recent Fox News poll, 67% of the public would support the legalization of illegal immigrants if the appropriate corollary steps were taken. There are five issues connected with this legalization proposal. First of all, the unit of legalization should be the household, not the individual. The proposed process, a registration step, all undocumented household heads would register, seeking permanent legal status, would register with the USCIS. Failure to register would subject undocumented household members to deportation. Eligibility. The eligibility criteria for legal status might include proof of employment or other source of non-governmental income, no criminal record, possibly absence of serious infectious disease. The requirements for legal status might include payment of a fine, English language proficiency, ability to pass a citizenship exam, not necessarily, this would be independent of the citizenship process itself, but the exam, I think, would be an important criterion. There would be a probationary period. I would recommend 5 years from registration to permanent legal status. And in the interim, all registrants would have temporary status permitting them to work, attend school or college, and so forth. Final point, immigrants' children born in the U.S. are by right already citizens. We must, in the legalization legislation, develop a humane protocol for those children and households whose adult members are not successful in legalizing their status. Now, some of what I propose here is actually not radically different from the McCain-Kennedy bill that was defeated, but I think it is much clearer and crisper makes it, you know, much more certain that all of the current illegals, or at least most of the current illegals, would be legalized. The third and final point, we must, and this is actually the one area where I think I depart most from a lot of the other immigration ideas kicking around now, we must redesign the legal immigration framework. I recommend curtailing quotas based on the sponsorship concept. Instead, the majority of immigrants with characteristics that we think are important should be admitted pretty much on a first-come, first-apply basis and to be self-sponsored under an enlarged global immigration cap. Regarding the present quota system, over 3 years, we should reduce the family sponsorship quota to approximately 250,000 and limit it only to immediate family members. We can keep the current employer sponsorship and refugee asylee quotas at current levels. We can eliminate the diversity quota of approximately 44,000 because we won't need it. The major concept here is that we add a new quota for self-sponsored immigrants. An initial level that I recommend would be 300,000. We move eventually to 750,000 annually. The annual number admitted from any country under this new quota would be limited to 30%. As in the provisions for legalization, the unit of admission under the new quota would be the household. All household members must be specified in the initial application and counted against that year's quota. If the household is admitted, there would be a grace period for the actual arrival of family members other than the household head. Next, admission would depend on characteristics of household heads and other adult household members. the criteria for admission, like the Senate bill that was recently proposed, would be based on a point system, substantially similar in some of the features, including points for English language proficiency, years of education completed, willingness, ability to work in essential occupational fields. Those fields could include meatpacking. They could include low-end occupations. They would not just have to be computer engineers. If we really need fruit pickers and meatpackers, then have the Labor Department say we need them, and they could be in, you know, criteria that would enable applicants to gain points. Family ties, as in the Senate bill, could also be considered. We could have any number of characteristics, and we could change the characteristics over time. All applicant households would enter a global queue under which their position in line would depend on the number of points they were awarded and the date of their application. There would not be a guest worker program. I think that if, as I assume and firmly believe, we must be able to assimilate immigrants that come here. Nothing will so guarantee that we don't assimilate them as having a guest worker program. So I think that the temporary categories that we have now, which I would maintain, take care of some of the labor market issues. The rest of it could easily be taken care of with this new quota. I'd like to conclude by just mentioning three items which are not officially part of immigration policy, rarely mentioned in connection with immigration policy, but I think that they should be part of an immigration package. First, we should encourage citizenship. The gold standard of assimilation is citizenship. Therefore, we should encourage almost all legal immigrants to become citizens and to overhaul the naturalization gauntlet. That includes strengthening the citizenship examination, but more importantly, expediting naturalization processing. Last year, we processed 700,000 new applicants for naturalization. Second, we should underwrite a national program of English as a second language instruction and citizenship instruction. We have programs all over the country. They're poorly funded. They're oversubscribed. This is an important part of making assimilation of new immigrants successful. And finally, something which will seem like truly, futile or unrealistic, but I feel that this is something we should consider, discourage dual citizenship. The legality of dual citizenship is already dubious. We should make it explicitly undesirable, if not outright illegal. As part of the citizenship oath currently, new naturalized citizens have always pledged, and I quote, to renounce and abjure absolutely and entirely all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty to whom or which the applicant was before a subject or citizen. That's in the oath. The Immigration and Nationality Act specifies that U.S. citizens may forfeit their citizenship by becoming a naturalized citizen of another country or declaring allegiance to another country after reaching the age of 18. Admittedly, recent court and administrative decisions have made the policy restricting dual citizenship an absolutely dead letter. I believe we should revive it. Thank you.
I think in the interest of time, I'm going to really sort of curtail what I have to say, only that I strongly agree that the next presidential administration will not initiate, at least up front or early on. It will engage in a series of tests. It will come out of the Congress through careful negotiations. But I do believe it will happen in the next administration. But it's going to have to be, I think, something that the president, whoever he or she is, feels comfortable having sort of broad-based prior support, or in the vernacular, bipartisan support in the Congress. The other thing is that I think, to some extent, the question of border curtailment is very important. It's going to be the thing that has to be sort of the sine qua non of any sort of immigration reform. But at what price? I think no one has really thought about at what price and how much immigration do we actually, illegal immigration, do we actually curtail? Most firms, for example, don't strive to eliminate the last theft in their stores or from their employees. There's a notion that a certain amount of theft is inevitable. In politics, on the other hand, is the standard going to be such as it is in parole policy, where no parolee is assumed ever going to be someone who is going to be a recidivist? Do we design or try to design immigration control policy which will stop the last illegal immigrant from coming across the border? And so I do think that's the difficulty, coming up with a border control policy that, in a sense, has some kind of economic and fiscal sense attached to it. But we could go on, and I'm sure I'm holding back and trying not to abuse my privilege here. So let's open it up right away for some Q&A. I think Ethan has promised me some cards to keep those of you from out there who are inclined to rant and rave, as he said, under control. Does America need a new Americanization program to assimilate immigrants? Are immigrants assimilating naturally? I'm assuming this will be directed to Peter.
Right. Well, I think my colleagues would also may want to respond. Well, I think to begin with, I think that the sort of thought about issue in immigration is assimilation. Immigration is very common now across the world. We're not even the country with the largest percentage of immigrants anymore. We are, though, historically at least, more successful than most countries in assimilating immigrants. So I believe that we absolutely must do it. Now, I also want to clear away some popular misconceptions. One popular misconception is that immigrants today are harder to assimilate than immigrants used to be. Not so. In terms of my own research on the historical reality of immigration over hundreds of years in the United States, new immigrants always seemed alien at first. And even Swedes and Germans and Irish, which we now think are just sort of the, you know, ordinary stock of the Native American population, were considered exotic and difficult to assimilate when they initially came. Second point, that the success of assimilation in any country, and again based on the research that I've done, depends very much on the fervor with which the native population wants to assimilate immigrants. There are societies where that there's a great deal of indifference or even hostility to assimilating immigrants. Americans historically have wanted immigrants to become part of the American family and have supported assimilation. So I think that if we are unsuccessful, it is not because our immigrants today are Mexican rather than Jewish or Irish or Scottish or whatever we had in the past. It's because we don't put as much effort into it. Now, what effort do we have to put into it? I don't think we have to do anything too aggressively. I do think that the immigration policy itself, as I indicated, can foster assimilation if it looks to creating a process by which people that come here can join the American family. And I think that's the most important thing. I don't think we have to have English-only laws, because I think within one generation, all of the children of immigrants do speak English. I think it's not that difficult, though, to learn English. My wife, who is in the audience, teaches English to immigrants. And so I would definitely, encourage as many immigrants as possible either to come with English proficiency or to quickly learn English, but I'm not overly concerned about it. I think if we are determined to have an assimilationist approach to immigration, we will be successful in that.
The next question, I think this probably goes to Philip. What would be the economic impact of severe restrictions on illegal immigration in terms of, would the greatest impact be on agriculture, for example, and thus food prices or other sectors of the economy?
Okay, We have a big economy. We have about 150 million people in the labor force today. And the maximum estimate of the number of unauthorized workers is 8 million. So that's a little under 5%. So about 19 out of 20 workers today are legal immigrants or U.S. citizens. So about 1 in 20 is not. Of those 8 million unauthorized workers, only about 1 million are employed in agriculture. Most Americans and most unauthorized workers are employed in services. What services? Everything from janitorial services to personal household services to any service you can think of. That's where most Americans are employed. That's where most unauthorized workers are employed. Some are employed in construction, some in certain kinds of manufacturing. The question is, what would happen if, as Peter was saying and Frank was saying, it's really not a question of everybody's going to disappear. That's not realistic. The real question is, should the rate of increase continue? Because we've been adding something on the order of 400,000, 3,000 to 400,000 unauthorized workers per year to the U.S. labor force for the last 10 years. Okay? So the real question is not, are the people now here going to disappear? Unless something comes from Mars, that's highly unlikely. The real question is, should we allow people to continue to enter? And then where will the adjustment be? And so there in agriculture, agriculture offers jobs, not careers. People leave. That's why you want a constant inflow of new people. Janitorial services, it's a job. It's not a career for most people. People leave. The question is, as people leave, as even unauthorized workers leave, and they'll leave faster if they're legalized, those industries will have to adjust. There will be adjustment costs. There is no two ways about it. Most consumers will not notice it in food because, by and large, you just don't eat enough fresh fruits and vegetables. I mean, it's not like you eat two heads of lettuce every day. And the problem is you actually only eat, a typical household only eats 10 heads of lettuce a year. And the value of the farm worker wages is about 8%. So it's a dollar a head. That means you've got 8 cents worth of farm worker wages in there. So, I mean, even if it was free, you wouldn't really have a lot of extra money. But there would certainly be adjustments to make the switch from hand-picking that lettuce to a machine. A machine would be near as good. You would have to sort things, et cetera. So the main issue when thinking about this from an economic point of view, the flexibility is on the demand side. When the wages go up, we discover how to do things. Sometimes it's different. Sometimes it's often things you don't think about. You know, who would have thought of getting rid of parking attendants like they do in Germany and you have to prepay before you go in? That's actually spreading here. There's a whole lot of things, and it's really hard to predict exactly what will happen. But so far, we have a pretty flexible economy, and we have made adjustments. It won't be easy for some industries, some people will suffer in that adjustment, just like they do for freer trade. So having less migration will have costs. It's not like it's – but you can rest assured, in general, we went from 95% of the people producing food 200 years ago to 2%. We'll probably be able to make another transition again.
Yeah, I'd like to just
answer. Actually, we have another question. I want to make sure we can get around. But
I mean, this is an important point, and I really – not to – you know, be too aggressive in this, but I'd like to sort of, you know, because I think there is the assumption that if we stop illegal immigration, there is some sort of terrible impact on the labor market. There might be if we do it the Lou Dobbs way. But what I'm suggesting is we legalize the current illegal population. So, again, we're not losing any of those people now. They may now want higher wages if they're legal, and that's actually not a bad thing. And the second thing, as far as the future, and this, I think, relates to the point that you made earlier, I'm proposing that the aggregate quota be roughly the same as the combination of the currently legal and illegal inflow. So we won't have fewer immigrants. will just have almost all of them be legal. And if we really are so hungry for low-end workers, then let the Labor Department certify that we really need low-end workers and have them come in legally, not as guest workers, but as perfectly ordinary, regular immigrants. So I don't see, I mean, there will be an adjustment because one of the things that might happen with all of this legal immigration is that wages will go up, and that's actually, as Phil indicated, a good thing and might make us modernize some of these industries. But I don't, if the president actually did what I proposed, there would be no shortfall of labor available in that market.
Frank?
Just one further comment on this. I don't disagree with either of my distinguished colleagues, but I think there are serious questions, I think, about whether we can stop illegal migration. Well, I thought you said you wanted to legalize all the ones who are here now.
And then enlarge the quota of the legal.
Yeah, and I would be in favor of that. But I think the unsaid thing, just two points. One is that we need to have some mechanism for bringing in more legal unskilled workers. And the reason, I think, is because based on all the kinds of projections and so on that I've done, there's just not enough workers of that kind and are not going to be. I mean, the shortfall over the last 20 years, by my estimates, is 3 or 4 million. And in other words, if fewer and fewer people are not finishing high school in the United States or natives. The economy is still growing. We talk about having a high-tech, knowledge-based economy with more and more people getting college degrees and working in that kind of economy. In point of fact, the rate of college graduation has not changed in the last 30 years. That's another issue. And it's generating illegal migration at the high end of college-educated workers. But we could come back to that. But I think in addition to legalizing some of the existing unauthorized workers, because practically there's no alternative, we have to have some mechanism to bring in this labor. Phil thinks, I believe, that raising wages might be one of the possible adjustments, but as I look at the landscape, it seems to me that the resistance there's been to increasing the minimum wage suggests that the United States doesn't want to go that route. Now, maybe it's going to be forced to. But the hidden reason for this that nobody has commented on to any great degree that I'm aware of is that the demography of the United States has changed. We're not, most of us, very good with these questions of magnitude and questions of numbers. But this lower and lower fertility, more and more women working, more and more people, if not finishing college, going to college and community college, leaves fewer and fewer persons overall to do the scut work at the low end. And if we legalize everybody who's already here, which I'm very much in favor of for practical reasons, that'll handle the problem in the short run. But over time, this source of labor demand, I think, will still be there if we have any economic growth at all.
Well, you know, I think we've reached the end of our time. I really want to thank the panel members. This has really been fabulous, very packed time, and I appreciate the difficulty of managing under these time constraints. I appreciate the questions that came from the audience. I hope you found it enjoyable, and we've reached the end of the show.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.